Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for June 12th, 2022. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks here with you to talk some of the biggest shows in pro wrestling and some of those big shows that happened within the last 24 hours. We're going to get to the results of some of them, and then we've got a few more coming up later this month, which we will get to as well. First, a little housekeeping note, and next week will be Impact Slammiversary, starting right around this time, 1 week from now, on June 19th. So I will be going on the air right after Slammiversary goes off the air, taking your phone calls and emails on the Impact show. So if you are an Impact fan and you think we don't talk enough about Impact on this show, that is your opportunity to email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com, or call in after Slammiversary. We'll be talking about that show and so much more next Sunday night. Then I'll be off for 2 weeks. I'll be heading to New York to visit family, as I usually do during the summer. So we will have, fear not, we will have a show of some sort. So we'll have some guest co-hosts filling in for me during that time. So Wrestling Night in America will still be on the air, just with a couple different hosts, and those are some important weeks. I think Money in the Bank is in there as well, Forbidden Door perhaps. So I may be missing some very big shows coming up, but the rest of the PW Torch family will have you covered on those nights. Before I bring on our co-host for this evening, a first-time co-host of Wrestling Night in America, by the way, I do want to go over the results of the NWA Always Ready pay-per-view that took place last night. This is a show that you'll hear more from me about in text form, because I'll be writing about this and reviewing it in my next column in the Torch newsletter. So I personally am not going to be talking too much about it here tonight. I'll save all the good stuff for then. Trevor Murdoch started off the show defeating Aaron Stevens. Stevens, the former Damian Sandow. This was his swan song as he was retiring after this match. He did a promo later on in the show that made you think that maybe we haven't seen the last of Aaron Stevens. Pretty Empowered defeated The Hex, which is Allison Kay and Marty Bell, to win the women's tag titles, the NWA women's tag titles. Homicide defeated PJ Hawks, son of a longtime independent star Luke Hawks, to retain the NWA junior heavyweight title. Then Colby Carino cashed in an opportunity he had and ended up losing to Homicide for that NWA junior heavyweight title. Then we had Natalia Markova defeat Taya Valkyrie. Natalia Markova was seconded by Taryn Terrell. Jack Zane defeated Chris Adonis to retain the NWA national title. Tom Latimer defeated Scion. Tyrus over Mims to retain the NWA TV title. Doug Williams and Harry Smith defeated Bestia 666 and MechaWolf 450 to win the NWA tag titles. Camille defeated Kylan King to retain the women's title. Now, this show, Always Ready, was named after the former Zack Ryder, who is Matt Cardona, the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. Because of an injury he suffered at another show recently, he could not defend the title on this show. So they had a whole big deal at the end, including William Patrick Corgan coming out, and they ended up stripping Cardona of the title, and they had a four-way to crown a new champion, and the new champion is Trevor Murdoch. He defeated Nick Aldis, who was scheduled to challenge Matt Cardona for the NWA World's Heavyweight title. He also defeated Tom Latimer and Sam Shaw, the former Dexter Lumis in NXT, to win the NWA title. So that was the NWA Always Ready pay-per-view last night. I want to bring on now my co-host for the evening, Marcus Arias, PWTorch.com contributor. Marcus, first of all, welcome to Wrestling Night in America.
Hey, Greg. Greetings from the West Coast. Thank you so much for having me tonight, man. This has been something I've been looking forward to. You know, I got to say, when you reached out to me a couple days ago, I thought you were looking for the wrong guy. So I was about to tell you, I don't know who you're trying to get a hold of, but, you know, I'll do the show, but I think you're trying to get a hold of the wrong guy. Josh. Thank you. Big fan of the show. I'm absolutely honored to be here tonight with you. So, again, thank you.
Awesome. No, you've earned it. Absolutely. And I'm happy to have you here because we're going to talk about New Japan, which is, I know, something that's near and dear to your heart. But, you know, we're talking about Always Ready, the NWA pay-per-view. I'm curious if you've ever been able to check out the NWA show or, you know, is that on your radar at all as something you watch?
Oh, very much so. I was a big fan of the NWA during the early days of Power, right before the pandemic. When that happened and they went on their hiatus, it was a little trickier to watch when they started doing their pay model on site. But, you know, now that they're kind of going back to the way things were and they are doing a little bit more of, you know, the YouTube shows and putting out more content on a regular basis, it has been kind of fun to get back to all things NWA.
I think my viewing habits of the NWA sort of mirrored yours because when they started out on YouTube, it was a very easy watch. It was 1 hour each week, and it was not very time-consuming. And there's not many wrestling shows these days that you can say that about, that, you know, following a product not being too time-consuming. So it was something you kind of look forward to, that old-fashioned vibe, that old-school feel that they're going for. And then I think, you know, when the pandemic hit, you mentioned it, and they weren't taping, and then they come back with the pay model on Fight TV. And as sad as this sounds, with as much wrestling as there is out there, you almost look for reasons not to. You know, you almost
exactly.
Look for reasons not to watch things. And going to Fight and going to the weekly pay model was, unfortunately, the perfect excuse for me and I'm sure many others to say, well, I guess I can cross this off the list. You know, you got Rampage now, you got Dynamite now that they're really kicking up. So there just wasn't a lot of time to fit that in. And then once they went to Fight TV, you're like, oh, I don't feel obligated now. It's a lot harder to, you know, it's not as easy as going to click the YouTube and just start watching it. So that's the unfortunate part. I have tried to keep up with some of the comings and goings in the NWA. I've tried to catch up on some of their bigger shows and pay-per-views. I just sort of happened to have a hole free in my evening last night where I could sit down and kind of watch this. Otherwise, it may have just slipped through the cracks once again, unfortunately. So, you know, as I read through the results, is there anything, a lot of title changes on this show, but is there anything that stands out to you results-wise or, you know, the pecking order of any of the wrestlers or anything like that?
You know, I'm going to say having Trevor Murdoch regain the title, I think it was probably the right call. You know, to me, Trevor Murdoch really symbolizes what the NWA is about, just that old-school mentality, that old-school feel. And so, you know, with him regaining the title, it almost feels like a reset, but at the same time, not. Because, you know, with him having the title now, it makes me kind of wonder what's next. You know, do we get Nick Aldis again? I was going to say Zack Ryder, Matt Cardona, come back when it's all healed up and get his shot back. You know, there's a lot of different ways they can play this. You know, they are building contenders, which is always helpful. The other one is, just because I wasn't expecting it, was the Commonwealth connection of Doug Williams and Harry Smith getting that tag team championship. You know, Harry Smith, since coming back, has been on quite a tear. And I'm always happy to see Doug Williams hold a title. I don't care where. Just having him hold some sort of championship always makes me happy. So having that team, you know, doing what they're doing, you know, for me, you know, it's all I can ask for right now.
Yeah, for sure. And Harry Smith has been kind of on this weird journey. You know, he left MLW, which I know is a show you cover for PWTorch.com, and went to WWE, did a few dark matches, never actually wrestled on TV in this second go-around, and then was part of the cuts. And then he comes back, yeah. And now he's in NWA. Do you think there's a spot for him back in MLW, or do you think that this NWA sojourn is kind of a long-term thing for him?
You know, I think there's a spot for him, you know, as long as they maintain the Opera Cup, there's always going to be some connection to the Hart family, which, you know, gives Perry just a perfect opportunity to come back if he chooses to. The MLW roster has changed leaps and bounds since he's been gone. And so with in the event that he does come back, it's a new role for him. So, you know, I'm real curious to see what the Opera Cup next year looks like, and to see if he's involved in any way, shape, or form.
I think with going back to Trevor Murdoch, you know, he is, I think you described him very well. I think he's sort of a quintessential NWA guy. He's the stereotype of when you think of those smoky arenas that the NWA did TV tapings in and they ran in. I mean, he would have fit in that era, that look and everything like that. But I wonder, like, if that's more suited for the mid-card at this stage. You know, I mean, he was never a really major pushed act as a singles in WWE. He had some success as a tag team wrestler. You know, he's 41 years old now. So to me, I was surprised that he won the title, because I think he's a good act to have on the NWA show, because I do think he's a throwback to those NWA days, and he's almost the tie, you know, that connects those two eras together. But as a world champion, I just don't know. I don't know about that as a world champion. I don't know if you're someone who is not a weekly, you know, take myself for example. I'm not a weekly NWA follower. I thought I'd check out this pay-per-view, see what it looked like, and I see Trevor Murdoch wins the title. I don't know if that's going to get people super excited about the brand. Not to say that maybe Nick Aldis or Tom Latimer would, but it's an interesting choice, I think, from that angle, the way I look at it.
Oh, of course. Of course. I definitely see where you're coming from on that. But, you know, out of those four in that match, aside from maybe Aldis, I don't really know who else you would have put in that position.
Yeah. And really what this does for Aldis is, you know, he had a one-on-one match against Cardona here. And Cardona gets hurt. Now he gets thrown into a four-way. So really that lessens his chances of winning the title. And so he's got a kind of a gripe there. He's still got a gripe with Cardona, because if Cardona didn't get hurt, you know, he could have had a better chance of walking out of this show as champion. So I think it does give a little more for Aldis to do. And like you said, you know, Latimer, Sam Shaw, neither of those guys really strike me necessarily more than Murdoch as someone who should be the champion of a company's brand. So I think it was kind of a difficult blow dealt to NWA when Matt Cardona was injured. So we'll see how they pick up the pieces from that and where Matt Cardona goes from there. But if you are listening live and you want to call in and talk to PWTorch.com contributor Marcus Arias and me, Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, be happy to have you. 515-605-9345. You can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. Got a couple emails to get to. But Always Ready wasn't the only major show that took place last night. Depending on where you are, this took place early this morning. New Japan Dominion. And this had some serious repercussions for later this month at Forbidden Door, the joint NJPW-AEW pay-per-view that will take place. Let me first go through the results, and then I'll kind of pick and choose a couple things that are on my mind, Marcus, to run through with you. The first
sure.
match was Aaron Henare, TJP, and Francesco Akira defeating Taguchi, Master Wato, and Hiroshi Tenzan. Ishimori, ELP, and Ace Austin of the Bullet Club defeated Naito, Bushi, and Hiromu Takahashi. Toru Yano defeated Doc Gallows. Evil, Yujiro Takahashi, and Sho defeated Zack Sabre Jr., El Desperado, and Kenomaru to retain the never openweight six-man titles. The Great Okan and Jeff Cobb defeated Bad Luck Fale and Chase Owens to win the IWGP tag titles. Hiroshi Tanahashi defeated Hirooki Goto to advance to Forbidden Door to face Jon Moxley for the AEW Interim World title. Shingo Takagi defeated Taichi 11-10 in a 10-minute pinfall scramble to retain the King of Pro Wrestling title. Karl Anderson defeated Tonga to win the Never Openweight title. Will Ospreay defeated Sonata to win the vacant U.S. title. And Jay White defeated Kazuchika Okada to win the IWGP title. So talk about titles changing hands. Certainly a lot on the Always Ready NWA show, but also quite a few on Dominion. So just interesting here, and for full disclosure, and I've talked about this on the show before, my New Japan viewing has decreased since the pandemic as well for different reasons. I think the shows are harder to watch given the pandemic restrictions of the fans in Japan, although they're kind of there's a light at the end of the tunnel there, and they're kind of moving away from a lot of those restrictions. I did see there a couple of the more recent United States shows, which, of course, not everybody was on that, but several of the big stars were on those shows. So I want to start with the first match. And the first thing that struck me was Henare defeating Tenzan. That was the finish of the match. And I know that a lot of people from the outside, I don't really know what the feeling is from the inside, but a lot of people on the outside high on Henare. Can we read anything into him submitting or pinning Tenzan here in the opener? Tenzan, obviously a legend in Japan, who is every time I see a New Japan show that he's on, it always amazes me that he's still wrestling. I mean, when I first really got into New Japan a few years ago and was watching the G1, all I could think about was, man, Tenzan's moving slow, and here we are, you know, 6-7 years later. And he's still going out there. You know, he's in multi-man tags. Yep. He's protected for sure. But still, it's amazing. So, I mean, is that something that we can read into how New Japan feels about Henare? Or is there not really much to Tenzan anymore in terms of rub or star power to give off to someone like Henare?
You know, I think, one of the themes of the night was really United Empire kind of stepping up in a lot of their matches, and this was the beginning, right? So having Henare not just, you know, get a win over Tenzan, but get a definitive submission win, to me, means something. It, you know, kind of going forward a little bit, but, you know, they did announce the G1 participants this year. Henare made the cut, which, you know, the last couple of years, he's always been kind of right on the bubble of someone that is, you know, when they make the cut for the participants, you know, it's always, well, maybe next year he'll get there. Maybe next year he'll get there. Well, Henare got there. He's in the G1. He submitted not only a New Japan legend, but a legend in the G1. So to me, this is, you know, New Japan putting a little bit of weight on Henare's name going forward.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I think it's no coincidence that he wins and beats Tenzan here the same time that they announce him as being part of the G1. And so we will talk about that a little later on as well. The G1 participants were announced, and so we'll kind of analyze that as well. The second match, Ace Austin. Most notably known for his run in Impact Wrestling. And I've been a fan of his in Impact. I think he does a really good job there. What is something that you've seen him bring to? I know he hasn't been in there a long time, but what is something you see him bring to the Bullet Club?
You know, for me, I think Ace brings that kind of bombastic, you know, energy that hasn't really been seen in Bullet Club for a while. Well, maybe to me, not since El Fantasma joined. Just that, you know, very high impact, very quick, Character-wise, I love Ace Austin as a character. He just has that. I always say he's just the right amount of scummy. He's just the right amount of a jerk, but you still, even though he's a heel, you still kind of like him. But you know, having him in Bullet Club brings one. It carries over the Impact relationship, which I'm all for. Now you have within Bullet Club in Impact, you had Chris Bay. Now you have Ace Austin B, and with him being the X Division champion, kind of adds an extra layer to that. So, you know, to me, that tells me that the New Japan Impact relationship is still going pretty strong. And then just having him around, you know, one thing I really liked about this year's Best of Super Juniors, having the international talent back was getting new eyes on talent they wouldn't have seen otherwise. And crowds really seemed to be high on Ace Austin during the tournament. And so having him be in Bullet Club kind of cements him as a fixture going forward.
Tetsuya Naito also in the second match here on the losing end of the second match. Like I said, my New Japan viewing has kind of gone in and out. I think Naito's had an injury recently. Does that explain him being on the second match on the card? Because, I mean, that stands out to me in terms of the hierarchy of how this show was built. Is someone the level of Naito being in a multi-man match second on the show? It's just something that stood out to me. Is that injury related, or is there something more there?
You know, last I checked, he was still recovering from eye surgery, I believe. He's probably still not 100%. You know, he's still feeling the effects of that leg injury at last year's G1. So, you know, he's just, you know, I love Naito, but he's kind of approaching that Tanahashi level of being held together by duct tape and bubble gum. You know, he just needs to, you know, get some rest, you know, rehab a little bit. Naito has always kind of had the reputation for just always wanting to go, no matter what the consequences. And, you know, unfortunately, I think we're reaching that point where Naito needs to, you know, kind of back off a little bit and take some time to fully heal. Because, you know, you're right. Having him at this part of the card stands out for sure.
Yeah. And speaking of injuries, this gets off the beaten path a little bit here, but I want to ask you about Kota Ibushi and his situation with New Japan. You know, it's taken some dark turns with him going on social media and kind of exposing things that I don't think New Japan wants exposed, talking about things that I don't think they really want discussed out in the open. How repairable is that relationship? And if Ibushi is truly done in New Japan, what does New Japan lose in losing someone like Ibushi?
Oh, boy. You know, I would have said that the relationship between the two parties is repairable up until the moment where Kota had mentioned that the goings-on between the two has affected his personal life with his family. To me, that's something that is going to make things really difficult to patch up entirely. Not impossible, but definitely difficult. It sounds like they are reaching some sort of agreement. There's been wage garnishing. There's been corporate restructuring. There have been changes involved that you know could lead to Kota coming back, you know, full time. If he leaves, you know, the question becomes where would he go? You know, he's a higher paid member of the roster. There's really nowhere that I could think of in the Japanese system that it would be comparable. Maybe Noah, but that would be it would be a cut of some sort. I mean, all Japan couldn't afford him. you know, Big Japan sure won't. So that leaves, to me, that leaves Noah. Now, that does kind of bring in the Cyber Fight family. You know, he could go back to DDT if he chose to, as kind of a, you know, just for fun, I guess. But a full-time promotion, you know, I don't know. And then the other thing is, because of the stuff that he's brought up, would another promotion want to do business with him? Because some of the stuff he brought up, you know, they don't like to peel back the curtain that much over there. And he didn't just peel it back. He ripped it down. And that could have some potential repercussions.
It's so hard to sort of predict what he'll do, because I think Ibushi has always marched to the beat of his own drum. You know, he's a very different kind of guy, motivated by maybe different things than others in wrestling are motivated by. So it's really hard to predict. I think, like you said, the Japanese landscape is not necessarily built for someone of Ibushi's level to leave New Japan and fit in somewhere else, making the same kind of money and at the same level on the card. You know, I wonder if Mexico would be an option for him or something like that, you know? So it's just, yeah, it's very up in the air. You really wonder how this situation will resolve itself. And because there are so few options, what leverage does Ibushi have, you know, at this point? Unless he goes, you know, full-time, like I said, to another country, Mexico, United States, or something like that, which I don't know if he really has any interest in. I've never really seen him have that kind of interest in doing something to that level. But back to Dominion. We have – what's the next thing I wanted to ask you about here? Well, let's go to the Tanahashi-Goto match.
Sure.
I don't think there were any folks who closely follow the product who believe that Goto is really going to win here. Tanahashi, John Moxley, Forbidden Door. Let's first take it from the New Japan point of view, because I think we can look at this from two points of view. Let's look at it from the New Japan point of view first. Tanahashi being the guy, beating Goto. What does this do for New Japan to have someone like Tanahashi battling for the interim AEW championship? And is there anyone else on the roster that you would have handpicked to be in that spot over Tanahashi? I mean, I guess it all depends on your philosophy. You know, you could use someone, you could use that opportunity to elevate someone in New Japan by having them interact with Moxley and fighting over the title. You know, you could use someone like Tanahashi, who's a major star. What would have been your choice, if not Tanahashi, to have been put in this place to face Moxley at Forbidden Door?
Oh, okay. So my choice, you know, I understand why they're going with Tanahashi. I do, you know, like we're talking with Trevor Murdoch representing the NWA. Tanahashi represents New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's just, he is the flag bearer. So I get it. For me personally, though, I would have probably put someone like a Shingo Takagi into that spot. I think the match as a whole would be better. I think Shingo, you know, Shingo has history with John Moxley from years ago too. So I mean, you do have that connection as well. For me, Takagi all the way.
Yeah, I think there were other options. I don't know if this is a New Japan choice or if Tony Khan had kind of requested, since it is for his AEW interim title, if he had requested Tanahashi here. But from an AEW perspective, and this is one of the things that has been brought up this week since the very polarizing episode of Dynamite on Wednesday night, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on. We have an email question about that particular episode. You've got Jon Moxley, who beat Kyle O'Reilly on Dynamite, to face either Goto or Tanahashi for the AEW interim title. Is there a risk of kind of alienating AEW fans, or you know, what is the message sent here by AEW that we have an interim championship, a world championship, and it's going to be decided when half the wrestlers in the match are not even AEW contracted stars? You know, I think to a certain extent, Tony Khan gets these stars in his eyes about Forbidden Door, and he looks at that as this pedestal type show, where it's the coming together of two major world promotions in a way that we've not seen before, at least in his lifetime, probably. And I think that the prestige of that almost trumps, in his mind, the need to make at least the AEW interim title seem like a legitimate AEW title, because it, I think there are some serious questions when you have Tanahashi and Goto, two non-AEW wrestlers, fighting over the opportunity to face, to vie for the interim AEW title. And maybe if this was WWE, no one would care because people get title shots on a whim in WWE. But I think AEW has built itself up as being something different, where title shots are earned and you have to win matches and there's a ranking system. So to have New Japan wrestlers get that opportunity over other bigger AEW stars, many of whom were not even in the Battle Royal on Wednesday, is that a problem for AEW, you see? What kind, is that a messaging problem for the fans, do you think? Or are the fans just going to be so happy to see Moxley versus Tanahashi that they'll kind of hand wave away the way that they got there?
I think a majority of the AEW fan base, you know, the hardcores, so to speak, will be so excited that it's Tanahashi against Moxley that, you know, anything else is completely secondary. The issue I have with it, though, is let's say Tanahashi wins, because for all I know, Tony Khan might do that. He's just crazy enough that he might do that. What do you do with Tanahashi if that's the case? Does he come over to the States until Punk rehabs? Does, you know, recently Tanahashi has not challenged, but has extended an offer to CM Punk for Wrestle Kingdom. You know, that's 7 months away. So what do you do, you know, hypothetically, with a champion that's not, or an interim champion that is not, in, you know, actively involved in
the product? And I guess that's another problem with this whole situation is, you know, even if you're excited about Moxley versus Tanahashi, there's got to be only a very small minority of people who actually think Tanahashi's going to win. Would you have better been served by doing Moxley versus, let's say, Kyle O'Reilly even, for the interim title, where you probably don't believe Kyle O'Reilly has a chance of winning, but he's part of the Elite with Adam Cole. I mean, he's been racking up some wins on TV. In the back of your mind, you can kind of see that happening. Whereas with Tanahashi and Moxley, obviously good match. Obviously a big deal to have this level of a match on a pay-per-view, but do you really believe he's going to win? I guess that's another issue too with it.
Exactly. And you know, having a compelling challenger, you know, definitely adds more to the match. You know, they have spent a lot of time building up Kyle O'Reilly, and as it stands right now, I don't know what for. You know, he's had these great showings. You know, he had the great match with Darby at Double or Nothing. He won the Battle Royal. He's won some, you know, pretty big name singles matches as of late. They're building him up for something. I have no idea what that is at this point. Uh-huh. And so, you know, if you had him in this spot, in my mind, there'd be a higher percentage of him winning. I'm not saying he would win, but there's definitely a higher percentage of maybe that happening. As it stands right now, it's not a lock, but let's be real, Moxley is probably going to win this.
It's a good problem to have, I guess, because I don't think you could go wrong with either result, depending on what kind of schedule Tanahashi's going to do in AEW. The outcomes are Moxley versus Punk at some point to merge the titles, or Tanahashi versus Punk, which either one of those I think would have a tremendous amount of interest from AEW fans. So you said Tony Khan is just crazy enough to possibly put the title on Tanahashi. I would agree. And again, I don't think there's a wrong answer here. I think both guys, from a pure selfishly my own interest in seeing either one of them against CM Punk is very high. So, it's an interesting move to involve New Japan in this. We'll see how it works out. The King of Pro Wrestling match, this was interesting to me. The 11-10, so the way that this worked was, it was Takagi and Taichi, and any attempt at a pinfall, if you got the referee to count two, you got 2 points. If the referee only counted one on a pinfall attempt, you got 1 point. And it was basically the highest point total at the end of 10 minutes won. And we've seen pro wrestling companies dabble with changing things up. We've seen WWE back in with the hardcore title, now with the 24/7 title, do something different. We've seen Impact Wrestling when they did the judges and they did the scoring, the three rounds matches. This was really interesting to me. I know for the King of Pro Wrestling, the match styles are chosen. So, when Yano had the belt, it was all kinds of crazy stuff and fans can vote on it and things like that. So this isn't, the only stipulation you're going to see in a King of Pro Wrestling match, but I mean, what did you think about this? This was my first time really experiencing it, and I thought it was kind of fascinating the way it played out. I certainly wouldn't want to see it on every show or in every match, but for something to throw out there for a specific championship, since that's all the rage now is throwing out these random championships and creating these title belts in professional wrestling, it did kind of strike me as very interesting.
Oh, without a doubt. This was probably the most I cared about a KOPW championship match since its inception. I'll be honest, when they first announced the stipulation, I was trying to wrap my head about the way they initially explained the rules. It wasn't clicking for me, and actually watching the match, I was really intrigued by this. I thought the last 90 seconds or so were really compelling. When it boiled down, yeah, to Shingo getting a 1 point advantage over Taichi at the last possible second. I thought that was really fascinating stuff. And yeah, again, the first time I've really, I watch the KOPW matches. I do, but I never really have that level of, engagement. It's really, I was glued to my TV watching this thinking, hey, there's an actual chance that like, something cool is going to happen here, which I haven't really seen since the KOPW trophy was introduced. So I liked it. Shingo and Taichi have really kind of become a premier program for me as of late. They've had several matches over the last few months or so, and every time they do something, it gets a little crazier, but also a little better. And I'm curious to see where this goes next, because this was a lot of fun.
I think to me too, and I'll speak a little philosophically on pro wrestling now, is time was, if you wanted to stand out, you would have really good matches, because on TV you had so many squash matches and you had to go to pay-per-view to watch, the really good matches. Now, you have so much wrestling on television and so many good matches. I mean, it's a yawner to have a 4-star match on Dynamite every week now. Like, it's almost commonplace. So to me, with so much wrestling out there and so much good wrestling out there, that's no longer a hook for a lot of people. It's become commonplace. And you have more fans now who grew up in that era where of three-hour Raws, of wrestling on almost every night of the week, of, you know, good matches, not just on pay-per-view but on television. So how do you continue to grab their interest? How do you continue to get them watching? And it might take something, you know, completely rethinking the idea of professional wrestling from bell to bell. And that's kind of what this match does. And again, it's not something that you can probably see every week or all the time or anything like that. But I think it shows that it's valuable to kind of rethink what professional wrestling is and what it can be, because the person who rethinks it into something different than it is now, still really good and really compelling with good stories and good matches, but tweaking what it is, I think, is going to be onto something. Because, like I said, it's just we get so much wrestling, we're inundated with it. It goes back to what I said at the outset, where you're almost looking for excuses of why not to watch something these days, because it's all-encompassing. And so that's kind of what I think of when I see something like this. I think of, you know, something like, maybe not this exact idea, but something like this. If someone can come up with a way to tweak the rules of professional wrestling and offer something truly different, that might be the next money-making idea in the industry.
For sure, you know, because there's so much wrestling out there, in order to get eyes on the product, you have to do something different. You have to find some way to set yourself apart, from other promotions, other companies, no matter what you're doing. And having something like the KOPW trophy that does evolve. I mean, there's been promotions that have experimented with this before. You know, Progress had the Atlas Tour, the Proteus Championship that you know, every champion, every match would have a different stipulation. Wrestling Revolver has something similar. KOPW, every match is a different stipulation, different format, and it helps to keep things fresh. It helps to keep things different, you know, because, you know, when you're watching 3, 6, 9, 12 hours of wrestling a week, if not more, it does kind of blend together. And so to have something completely different that is just good or bad, you know, like I say, the KOPW is, when it was first introduced during the pandemic, you know, I get it. They needed content. They needed something to have kind of in their back pocket because they just needed to fill time. And I understand that. But they have actually established this as something, you know, to watch. And even though some of them don't always hit, some of them are misses, they're at least different. And I have to give credit to New Japan for pushing that.
Yeah. And the last match before we go to the phones is the main event, Jay White over Okada to win the IWGP Heavyweight title. The semi-main event, by the way, Will Ospreay versus Sonata. I mean, really good match. Maybe my favorite match on the show to win the vacant U.S. title. But not much I want to talk about there, so we'll go to the main event. how do you read Jay White winning here? Is this to set up something at Forbidden Door? Is it to set up the summer of the G1 Climax series? What can you read into him winning the title at this moment?
You know, a couple things. There's been reports going around that Okada is going to be taking time off for to be a father, which is fantastic. But, you know, so he's going to be off doing that. So we have to have someone kind of fill in, you know, in the interim. I've been saying interim all night, but the interim. And Jay
White.
That's
the secret word of the night on Wrestling Night in America, yeah. By the way.
Yay. But Jay White is that, you know, has proven himself to be a guy that they can certainly, you know, give him the go-ahead to go do something. And every time he's been able to step up. And this is another opportunity for him to step up. He's been with his absence from Japan for the last year and a half. But since he's come back, he has established himself as one of the main guys for New Japan. He's done great work while he was working with Impact. He's had his moments in AEW. You know, I think this is kind of a tip of the cap to Jay White for what he's been doing the last, basically on his own the last year and a half. Now going into Forbidden Door, it does kind of change things a little bit. I was excited at the idea of a Hangman and Okada match. I'm still excited about a Hangman and Jay White match. The X factor here is Adam Cole, because they did kind of insinuate that it would be at least possibly a three-way between Cole, Page, and Okada. Now that kind of changed things a little bit, but I think Jay is somebody that's going to be doing big things, and now that stuff's opening up, it's going to be bigger things.
Yeah. Well, that is Dominion. As I said, we'll go through the G1 roster a little later on and kind of get your thoughts on that, Marcus. But let's go to the phones right now, first caller of the evening. It is the 814 area code. It is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first question for us tonight?
My first question is, can you see Austin Theory and Alexa Bliss being the winners of the Money in the Bank this year, or do you think it's going to be somebody else?
I could actually see both of them being the winners, Ryan. Theory, obviously, has got the backing of Vince McMahon both on screen and off. I think they see him as a big star, and if you want to give that big star a boost, what better way than to have them win the Money in the Bank ladder match? And just the way it's been framed on television over the last week, I know they haven't had a ton of time to plug it yet. It's almost like, giving that first opportunity to a wrestler to win the title. It's not the announcers haven't been talking about it as, a veteran like Randy Orton can go in and win. It's almost like they're pushing specifically the idea of a first-time young winner who's maybe going to use this to win the title for the first time. So if you want to read that far into their comments, Theory would be a good winner. You have Alexa Bliss, who has returned from being off TV and doing the stuff with The Fiend, and she's now more quote-unquote normal, I guess, normal Alexa Bliss character. And they really haven't found something to sink her teeth into since she's returned. So giving her the Money in the Bank briefcase could sort of kick off that next chapter for her and would give her a storyline. So I'll throw it to you, Marcus, for potential Money in the Bank winners, what you think about Theory and Bliss as potential winners, and if there's any other obvious potential winners a couple weeks out that you think WWE might go with.
I think Theory is a great call. Prior to last weekend, I would have said Cody, but right now my money is on Theory. I think the Money in the Bank concept to me always did better with a heel. The concept just feels more heelish to me just as a whole. Theory does kind of give me that Edge ultimate opportunist kind of mentality. Take my shortcuts. I'm going to do what I need to do to get that title. So if he gets that Money in the Bank, it fits what he's doing. It fits the character so well. Alexa, someone I was not thinking prior, but made compelling points. since her return. You know, people are really on board with what she's doing. I would be curious to see how her winning kind of plays into the bigger picture of things, but I think that's a good call.
Yeah. Ryan, back to you for your second question for us.
Second question is, I don't know if you saw this match last week on Impact. It was between PCO and Steve Macklin. I just don't know how they pulled this off. It looked like PCO, like, dislocated his arm, had some sort of weird arm injury, but he was, like, destroying, like, the officials that were coming down to try to, like, help him, you know, from trying, you know, to stop the match. But PCO had different thoughts and just killed these guys. So I think it'd be pretty dangerous, you know, if you had a dislocated arm just to be trying to do spots like that, or maybe he's just double jointed and was able to pull it off like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I saw the match, and I always wonder about PCO because of, you know, that's part of his character where he just, you know, fights through all these, you know, he, you know, sometimes causes himself pain on purpose. So I sometimes wonder about that. The match was gruesome. I mean, oh boy, that was a wild brawl, and PCO looked rough by the end of it. You know, bleeding out of the mouth, and that looked like a pretty bad mouth injury that he had there, pretty legit, got busted open hard way there. But yeah, I mean, if that was a legit injury, certainly dangerous to work on it and not let others help you. Marcus, I don't know if you had a chance to see that match or anything like that, but PCO, man, he just keeps running. That train keeps moving.
Well, you know, PCO is not human. That's not just a tagline. I think that's 100% legit. I don't know how PCO does half the stuff he does. I did see the match, and guys, I'll be honest with you. I rewound that probably about 4 times. So I was trying to figure out exactly what happened because it was gnarly. I don't know. Something like that. I mean, I don't know much about being double jointed, but I don't know if you can be double jointed in your collarbone. I don't know. But just the whole thing, the whole match, yes, brutal was a good word for that. It was bloody. It was violent. I don't know exactly what came from that, but you know, PCO is one of those guys. Every time I see him, he finds a way to do something potentially crazier than the last time I saw him. And, you know, since his resurgence over the last couple of years, he's done some crazy things, almost to the point where, you know, it's diminishing returns. Because at what point does PCO do something so crazy that it's no longer worth it? That's my only concern. You know, I enjoy what he does, but I do get scared that at some point it's going to be a little too much. And if this was legit and he was continuing the match with an injury like that, if, you know, he thinks he can pull that off, more power to him. But at some point you do kind of have to analyze that and think maybe not a good idea to keep doing this. So.
I never would have guessed when I was watching them in the mid-90s that Quebecer Pierre would be this crazy hardcore wrestler in 2022.
Yeah.
It's just it still blows my mind that they're the same guy. He still is being billed for Slammiversary. So it's not like he's been taken off the Slammiversary card or anything like that with this injury. So something to keep track of for sure, though. And Ryan, we'll go back to you for your third and final question for us tonight.
Final question is something that I saw. It was a couple months ago on an indie show. The champion threw the title in like a garbage bag, and he brought out this new title. It's the world championship, and the reason he did that is because he's going overseas to wrestle this guy called CJ Carter in England, and they're renaming the title the world championship since he's defending it. ever see it. So I guess it's sort of like their version of Forbidden Door, since it's like a international event. So my question is it common for like these indie leagues to work with like a foreign country and then call their title the world title because they can justify it because they're getting overseas?
Yeah, time was people had respect for what a world title was versus just a company title, right? Like, I remember reading Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and some titles were world titles if they were actually defended all over the world. Some titles were just that company's title because they defended it in a certain area of the United States, and they didn't defend it elsewhere. So, and now I think today world title has become more synonymous with just the main title of the company. I don't think people look at it necessarily as, you call it the world title, but are you defending it across the world? I don't think people look at it that way. They just hear world title and say, oh, that's the main title of that company. So, that's kind of my take on it, Marcus. I don't know if you want to add anything to the world title discussion.
No, I agree. Now we are seeing more championships defended, or at least we were, on a global scale. The Independent Wrestling Television Championship was defended overseas, which did make it an official world title, which was still really cool to see an independent championship get world title status. But for your local indie, having the word world in front of it give it a little more gravitas? Sure. But does that, at the end of the day, does it actually mean more or less? Because if it's an independent championship, does the scale, go up for that championship? So, for me, if it's a promotion's main title, it could just be, the main title. It doesn't necessarily need to have world in front of it. It's still premier title for that company.
I don't think there's any governing body telling a local independent company that they can't use the word world in their title because they're not defending it all over the world. So we know that wrestling promoters are not always on the up and up, so they'll call their main title a world title, whether they defend it all over the world or not. And someone try to stop me. It was basically their opinion on it, I think. Ryan, thank you for the phone call. I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Let's go to the emails here and pick one out. This is we talked a little bit earlier about AEW this week, and this is from Dan, who's from Leeds, England. He says, "Evening, Greg and Marcus. Several flaws were highlighted in a dispiriting latest episode of AEW Dynamite. The degrading of the company's major title through a complex and needless interim title series, the introduction of yet another unnecessary title belt are both major concerns, but the most glaring for me is the confused cross-promotion between multiple companies. I'm a longtime WWF fan who was attracted to AEW as it was a refreshing alternative. I have no prior knowledge of ROH or NJPW. I don't mind that either company are featured, but do need some context as to why they should take precedent over multiple AEW talents. I know the name Will Ospreay, but was given no background on his appearance on Dynamite. Likewise, introductions to Jay White, Tanahashi, and Finlay. A brief video package on NJPW and its stars would help build a connection. AEW is in such a hurry to move on to the next segment that very little care is given to the context of these invading forces and how the casual fan should feel. With Forbidden Door on the horizon, I worry that AEW will continue to cater to the minority who recognize these NJPW talents and leave the ambivalent AEW fan feeling like they weren't invited to the party. Do you feel AEW need to do more to explain the rich history of NJPW and why it is so important in the AEW narrative? Apologies for the long comment/question. Please edit for brevity if need be. Thanks for all the hard work at the Torch and the tremendous Wrestling Night in America. Go VIP." Thank you, Dan. PWTorch.com/goVIP is where you can go. I listened to Wade Keller and Todd Martin this past week, speaking of VIP, on talking about Dynamite and their frustrations with it this past week, largely centered around the fight for the interim title, how it was set up, as well as the introduction of the All-Atlantic Championship. And I totally get both of those complaints. But I think the one brought up by Dan here via email is also a valid one, the lack of context to the New Japan stars and even some of the ROH stars who have made on-screen appearances since Tony Khan bought that company. And I do think he's right that there is just a sense as a viewer that AEW wants to quickly move on to the next thing, lest you turn the channel. And so I think that's where not taking the time to explain who these people are is a problem. Now, you could also say the vast majority of AEW fans are probably familiar with Ring of Honor, are probably familiar with New Japan. So is it worth taking television time, precious, important television time, to cater to maybe a minority of fans who don't know who these wrestlers are? So, Marcus, I'm going to throw to you. First of all, your thoughts on the way that they went about finding an interim champion, the addition of the All-Atlantic title, and then, to Dan's point, the lack of context given for these New Japan wrestlers.
Okay. So it is kind of a roundabout way of getting to this interim championship. There's been that whole episode tried to tie so many things together, but I think only made things even murkier. You had Wardlow, who did not want to participate in the Battle Royal because he wanted to wrestle Punk for the title. But if he won the Battle Royal, he would have a shot at the interim championship, and then he would have a spot at CM Punk at some point down the road anyway. Just kind of made things more convoluted than they needed to be. You had wrestlers that you know, they didn't want to be in the Battle Royal because they didn't want to have more than one match. Kyle O'Reilly wrestled in the Battle Royal and then wrestled in the main event of Dynamite. So that's not an argument. There's so many they're trying to do so much in a short amount of time. And right now that's kind of my issue with Forbidden Door as a whole. We just had Double or Nothing 2 weeks ago. We just had it. And now you are building another pay-per-view in a four-week cycle. Now, AEW usually runs every, four? And you have plenty of time to build and build and build. Right now, we're cutting that down to next to nothing. So we are down to 1 month between pay-per-views. You're trying to fit so much in a shorter amount of time than you typically have. And now throwing in New Japan talent. Now we're throwing in Ring of Honor talent. I do think, you are right. The core AEW audience is familiar, at least to some degree, of New Japan. Maybe Ring of Honor, but probably New Japan, because Bullet Club and the Elite were instrumental in getting fans interested in AEW as a whole. When you look at, the original All Out. It was a New Japan heavy product that got people interested in AEW. So I do understand that, but I do think because there's such a short amount of time, a video package would be super helpful, especially for the New Japan side of things. This episode had Aussie Open, which is one of my favorite tag teams on the planet. I adore their work.
Yeah.
I was watching the show with my girlfriend, who over the years is, I've kind of brought her into, the world of pro wrestling, who, obviously knows Will Ospreay and such. But she saw Aussie Open. Okay, cool. It's Aussie Open. Who is that? You know, and I'm geeking out. I'm nerding out watching this, but I'm watching this with people that aren't familiar so much, and just a little bit more than Excalibur going into turbo mode, explaining, you know, the history
right.
of the United Empire and everything would be just super helpful as a whole. Now, I know Wade and a lot of people, you know, talk about shoulder content and how, you know, you shouldn't have to watch shoulder content, and I get that, but this might be one of those rare occasions where even just a YouTube video, you know, 2 minutes long, explaining, you know, some of the New Japan factions, the history, a brief synopsis of some of the Ring of Honor titles, you know, Samoa Joe being the ROH TV champion. That's great. Have they really established what that means? Have they really talked about, you know, what it means to be the ROH TV champion? There's a legacy to that title that has kind of just been, well, it's there, it's an ROH title, it's been around for a while, okay, moving on. And there just needs to be, I don't know, just a more welcoming attitude to new fans. You know, we want to bring in those new fans. They need to bring in those new fans, and they make it difficult. And that's something that's been an issue for them since inception. And there's just, you know, a little video package, a little something to just kind of explain things a little better. You know, I don't think it's too out of the question.
And it is really going to be interesting to see how they portray the New Japan wrestlers over the next few weeks. Like, what lengths will they go to as they continue to build toward Forbidden Door? What effort is going to be put in on Dynamite and Rampage to explain to their viewers just who these wrestlers are and what they mean to New Japan? And, you know, I think that's something we can only really assess after Forbidden Door has taken place, once we've seen all of the AEW TV leading up to it. But certainly we'll see how much time AEW spends on their own TV show explaining to their fans who these wrestlers are, and especially ones high on the card where they're facing major AEW stars. So that'll be interesting to watch over the next few weeks leading into Forbidden Door. Want to go next? We got one more email to get to. We also want to talk about the G1 and Slammiversary, which is coming up next Sunday. But before we go to that, we'll go to DJ from Miami, who is on the phone now. DJ, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's on your mind tonight?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey. Doing well, thanks.
Hey, DJ.
Okay. I want to start off with Paige. She said she's leaving. Now, if she goes to EAW, do you think that she'll be like Brian and she'll do good, maybe wrestle? But I don't want her seeing doing that. I would like her to be a GM. Do you need a good GM? They don't have one. Or put her in the booth with JR. Tony doesn't do anything. Let him just do the ring and backstage. What do you guys really think at the end of the day? Where do you think Paige is going to take off time? Do you think she's going to go to EAW right away? What do y'all think?
So I think Paige announced, I don't know if this was on a Twitch stream or I was on Twitter. I think it was on Twitter. She announced that her contract is not being renewed by WWE and will be up, I think, early next month, early July. And I think that probably surprises some people that she's still under contract because she has not been used in a very long time. And, you know, she's been not medically cleared by WWE, but we've seen that others who have been not medically cleared by WWE, like Bryan Danielson, like Edge, have been able to come back. So it's hard to predict what she's going to do or where she's going to go because we don't know if she's going to wrestle again. I mean, we can assume she's going to try. I don't know that a general manager position in AEW would be the right move. I don't know about – I think to some extent AEW needs to better explain how they get to matches, but I don't know if an on-screen general manager is the way to go, just because I think that opens up so many – it's like a Pandora's box of booking crutches that are opened up when you have an on-screen GM. So I hesitate to advocate for her for that. Putting her on commentary is interesting. I don't know how comfortable she would be doing that. But Marcus, I'll throw to you. Where do you see Paige ending up when her contract expires?
You know, as if you were to ask me this right now, I don't see her getting back in wrestling, period, at least for some time. You know, she has other projects that she, you know, continues to work on. She does a lot with her Twitch stuff. She does a lot, you know, outside. So I don't see her really getting involved in wrestling, you know, as a whole. Now, if she did, I could see maybe commentary, maybe some sort of, almost a, I hate to use the talk show segments because I usually don't like those, but something in that capacity, an interview segment. The idea of an on-screen authority figure, you know, I know Tony Khan has said before that that's something he didn't want to do because that's what the other guys do, and he wants to be different from the other guys. So, you know, I don't see that happening. But, you know, again, if I would be okay with a commentary role for sure, if that's something that she's comfortable with and wants to do. But that's pretty much it for her as far as where I see her landing.
I think you bring up a good point too about the Twitch and things like that. I mean, there's avenues for women now, especially men too, but women more so, to make money based on the name they've made in professional wrestling, but to where they don't have to wrestle anymore. And I think doing something on Twitch is one of those ways to go. DJ, back to you for your second question for us.
Yeah, my second thing is fashions. Like, I just don't understand why they broke up the new, the whatever. You know, like, they broke up the New Day, then they played around with them, and now they're doing the Judgment. It's just like, I don't understand. And then all of a sudden, this is what's crazy. Edge is now a babyface in the roster. It's like, hey, F your mother, but then let's be best friends. Like, what? Like, this is crazy. Like, they had a great thing going on, and then, like, now they're going to fail. But NXT has 1,000 factions, or EAW has 1,000. I'm just so confused. But, like, nobody could ever have a good fashion. Even Bobby Lashley had a great fashion over. I don't get it.
Yeah.
So do you
I
guys
think
feel like
kind
Edge
of...
will be a babyface, or do you think he'll be off camera? I just don't understand, like... All of a sudden, he's going to fight with the – I don't know.
Well, the thing about Edge, too, is they wrote him off in a way to where he might be off TV for a while. And the best way to forget about all those nasty things he said as a heel is to come back as a babyface after you've been off TV for a while. And so I think that might be what they're doing. I totally get you about, you know, breaking up some of these factions – before their time, and I think the Lashley example with the Hurt Business is especially true. Scuttlebutt seems to be that WWE booking wanted the Judgment Day group to go in a direction that Edge did not want it to go in, and so they kind of said, okay, we'll take you out and we'll put someone new in, and which is exactly what they did. So that could have been at Edge's request. I'm not really sure the 360 view of that situation. But, I mean, Marcus, what do you think of factions? I think factions can be important. And, I mean, when you looked at the Hurt Business and you saw how much screen time it was giving guys like Cedric Alexander and Shelton Benjamin and the rub they were getting, it's easy to see why factions are a good thing, but then I think you look at AEW and you see how many factions are there, and it's taking it to the extreme where it's almost not so helpful because you have so many of them.
Well, first things first, I'm a faction guy. I love factions in wrestling. To me, it gives wrestling a, I don't follow, quote unquote, real sports. I don't follow team sports in any way, shape, or form. But to me, a faction kind of builds a team aspect to wrestling. You know, especially when you look at, some of the Japanese promotions where they really put an emphasis on faction warfare. So I love factions. I think it's a great way. They're great ways to get people to get involved in storylines that otherwise they might not have had a chance to, be involved in. Same thing with getting on TV. You do run the risk of having too many, and that is definitely possible. And in this case, breaking them up when they're right on the cusp of doing something, really big or building them up. Judgment Day, I will be 100% honest. I think having Finn in Judgment Day fits better than Edge, at least for me. Edge, I think with Edge, since he's returned to WWE full time, he can never be a heel. He's with everything he's been through with his retirement and his return, he's just the ultimate babyface now going forward. To me, what they were doing wasn't working. And so having Finn kind of usurp that role, to me, is more compelling. I think when Edge does come back, he will be, again, a mega babyface fighting, the faction that he helped build, which, we've seen before in other storylines, and a lot of times they're effective. As to why they break up factions, Hurt Business is a great example. I don't know. The Hurt Business is in my mind, was something that was so good, something that was so different. And then to abruptly just disband it, seemingly for no reason, just still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Maybe one day they'll have a reason, like a legit reason, but as it stands right now, I don't know what that is. But, I think, I don't know. I don't know if WWE specifically gets bored, for lack of a better word. They build up a faction, and then they think, well, wait a second, this guy is getting hot. Let's just pull him from the equation and let him do his own thing because he's now the new hot commodity. So, see what happens going forward.
All right, DJ, your third and final question for us tonight.
Yep, my last thing is Riddle. How they built him up in the beginning, and they talked about him wanting to fight Brock, he wanted to beat up, Goldberg. And then I see him wrestle a couple times, like, oh, my God, seriously? And then just, he was supposed to be a fighter, and then he's doing this weird Spicoli thing, and it's just like, I feel like he's so good in a tag team, now he's by himself. And I feel like if he's going to take on Roman, I don't know what's going to happen next week, but, do you feel like they're going to go a couple of times, so he's going to win the Money in the Bank, so we all know he's not going to win. And then so he has a couple times. Roman has a little time to, not do anything crazy, and, it gives, people something to watch until Cody comes back. Or where do you really think this is going to go? Because, I can't just sit here and watch Roman just not do anything for 500-600 days or whatever they're counting now. It's just like, Paul doesn't even come out a lot. Nobody's doing anything. It's just like, what do you really think at the end of the day? What's going to happen to Riddle? Because I don't even know when Orton's coming back. Or if there's even going to be a tag team,
I do wonder, if the Cody injury changed plans in terms of them maybe building up Riddle more as a babyface to make up for the lack of babyface stars that they lose by not having Cody for upwards of 9 months, if WWE's reporting is to be believed. I do think he's an interesting name to keep in mind for Money in the Bank if he gets there. I do agree with the idea that you know, if Roman Reigns, if the plan was always for him to cut back on his schedule, it's was probably not the best idea to put both titles on him, because now, you know, it's already hard to watch Raw without a title. It feels kind of directionless, but now SmackDown's falling into the same boat. And I think, you know, I don't hate the direction of Riddle kind of challenging Roman Reigns with Orton out of the equation for the time being. Like you said, don't know how long he's going to be out. I don't think it's necessarily a long-term thing, but it's just kind of giving – I think everybody likes the Riddle-Orton tag team, or a lot of people do, but it gives them a break and gives people an opportunity to miss that team, because WWE has been putting a lot of their eggs into that basket, and what can happen is you run it into the ground, and you've got 3 hours of television a week, you've got pay-per-views every month, and now you are using guys on Raw, you know, Raw superstars on SmackDown, and SmackDown superstars on Raw, so now you're talking about two shows a week that some of these guys are appearing on. Interest can wane pretty quickly on those wrestlers. So just giving them a little bit of a break and making people want to see them again, I think is smart. So kind of like what they've done with Riddle going after Reigns, but I think there's a bigger problem with having the title on Reigns, and I'm not sure when that situation is going to get solved. Perhaps, you know, September with Drew McIntyre winning one of the titles in Wales. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Marcus, I'll throw to you on the situation with Riddle and Roman Reigns.
Okay, so, you know, we've seen this before when Brock had the title. You know, he would go away for a while, but at the end of the day, we always had the SmackDown title to fall back on. So there was always at least one title that was being defended on a regular basis, even when one would kind of go on a hiatus. So right now we're seeing is there's nothing. There's no world title being defended, you know, on a pay-per-view, premium live event. I'm still getting used to that. And so what
aren't
we're seeing
we
right now is just kind of, it, right? Right now, is we are seeing what happens when you build up one specific storyline. You know, you can have your B stories and your C stories, but all your focus is on one primary storyline with its own set of repercussions. And right now, those repercussions are affecting the other shows, you know, so that creates a whole other set of problems. And, you know, I think, you know, you're on to something with Drew picking up one of the championships in Wales. You know, in the meantime, though, if Riddle is to challenge Roman, you know, at an upcoming show, I'm curious about that, because I think that's going to be kind of the litmus test for Riddle to see if he can be in a prominent position like that. We haven't really seen him be in that kind of environment where it's you know, a main event for a world championship since, you know, coming to the main roster. So to me, this is going to be a sink or swim. You know, can he maintain what he, you know, because he right now, RK-Bro insanely popular. They have been a highlight. You know, when I first saw them as a team, I was a little hesitant, but I'll be honest with you, they've grown on me as a team. Mm-hmm. And so having him now in a singles environment, taking on Roman for a major championship at a potentially major show, it's, you know, we're going to see exactly where Riddle is going to be on the hierarchy here.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's going to be interesting, because I think you could read into that booking, you know, eventually Riddle and Randy Orton's friendship is going to come to an end, and they're going to push Riddle as a singles after that. And I think we'll get a hint perhaps how far into the future that could be, based on the booking of him against Roman Reigns. DJ, thank you for the phone call this week. Look forward to hearing
you. I'll see you next week.
All right, a couple more things to get to. I want to go over the G1 lineup with you, Marcus, and this is the G1 Climax 32 participants. This is Okada, who won last year, Tama Tonga, Hiroshi Tanahashi, Filthy Tom Lawler, Jonah Yoshihashi. I should be doing this in my Vince McMahon Royal Rumble voice, but I don't know if I can get that gravelly. Yoshihashi, Hiroki Goto, Toru Yano, Ishii, Jeff Cobb, Great O'Khan, Will Ospreay, Henare, Takagi, Sanada, Naito, Jay White, Evil, Kenta, Yujiro Takahashi, Bad Luck Fale, Chase Owens, Juice Robinson, Taichi, Zack Sabre Jr., Lance Archer, David Finlay, and El Fantasmo. One of the things that jumps out to me is you got some big fellas in there. You know, you bring in Jeff Cobb, you bring in Jonah, Ishii's still in there, O'Khan is in there, Henare is in there, Bad Luck Fale is in there. I mean, Lance Archer. There's going to be some, as Big E would say, big meaty men slapping meat in this G1 climax.
Yeah.
So that's something for sure to look forward to. Marcus, your impressions, you know, kind of first blush look at this lineup for the G1 this year.
Okay, so I think the field is really good. I think it's really diverse. The surprise names, outsider names, being Tom Lawler and Jonah. Tom Lawler especially. I've been hoping that he would make it to a G1 since New Japan Strong started. So seeing him there, it really makes me want to watch even more because I'm a big fan of his work. Jonah, same, you know, having him involved in some capacity, you know, just like you said, you know, the matches that are on the table now of just these massive, you know, kaiju, just giant monsters fighting. I love that in my pro wrestling. So I'm all for that. The name that really stuck out to me is El Fantasmo. I've been thinking for the last 6 months or so, I expected him, and I still won't expect it, I expect him to officially move up to the heavyweight division at some point in the near future. And so I think this is kind of him testing the waters to see if that's something that you know, he can do full time, you know, with Bullet Club gaining, you know, Ace Austin, you know, that does free up a Bullet Club junior spot, and so to me, I would bump up El Fantasmo to a heavyweight and see what happens. Lance Archer, another, you know, representing AEW. I'm glad he's in. I always liked his work in his G1, so you know, I think that can potentially be a lot of fun. I know there were some rumblings and hopes that more AEW talent would be involved in this year's tournament, but you know, like we've seen with the injury bug and other things going on, you know, you can't send everyone over. You just can't. Mm-hmm. You can't send all of your top people. You know, we saw that with Wheeler Yuta, you know, going to Best of Super Juniors. He was out for a month, and his presence, you know, his lack of presence, you know, affected some of the stuff of Blackpool Combat Club. That was, and so if you take that in consideration for the G1, you know, are you really willing to take some of your major players off the board for that long a time? I don't know. You know, one or two, perfect. You know, like I say, Lance Archer, mm-hmm. awesome. He'll do some great stuff. You know, having him in a New Japan environment is fantastic. So, you know, as a whole, I think this is going to be a really good tournament. It does feel, you know, feels like a proper G1 with the international talent coming in, the the non-New Japan contingent coming in. It feels like a G1. It feels like G1 season.
Yeah. I think this is a really strong lineup. I'm really intrigued about this and really looking forward to the G1 this year just based on this lineup alone. As much as I've been looking forward to the G1 in a number of years, and this is one of those New Japan tournaments that I always try to make it a point to watch. And it was a lot easier to watch live when I was single and had my own apartment and didn't have any cares. But now all of a sudden, you know, I'm living with my girlfriend and her 5-year-old. So the days of getting up at 4:30 in the morning and watching them live is probably out the window. So I'll do my best to catch up when I can, but yeah, this is a really, I'm really intrigued by this. And, you know, I was going to ask you about Lance Archer. You sort of answered my question before I asked it about him really being the only AEW representative in this tournament, which, you know, AEW gets to send somebody over. They're not going to have to change booking plans because of it, because Archer, you know, was not a prominent figure lately in their booking. And it's someone who has experience doing this. You know, he's been in the G1 before. Tom Lawler is interesting, as you said, because he's, you know, part of the New Japan Strong lineup in the USA. Do you ever see a time where the New Japan Strong folks, whether it's Fred Rosser, whether it's, you know, Lawler again, whether it's any of the young guys like Clark Connors and Carl Fredericks, do you ever see a time where they play a more prominent role in the G1 tournament?
Oh, without a doubt, you know, with Clark Connors being involved in Best of Super Juniors, you know, I was expecting some of the LA Dojo guys in here in some capacity. I had my fingers crossed for Carl Fredericks. Obviously that's not the case, and I am a little disappointed in that. But I do think with things opening up, you are going to see more interplay between New Japan proper and New Japan Strong. So, you know, this is kind of the first real opportunity to kind of blend, at least in some capacity. I think next year we're going to see a different type of G1. I mean, we're already seeing that this year with with a field of 28, the four blocks, which is something different. You know, it leads me to think that next year is going to be, and I know we're going way ahead because this year hasn't even started yet, but it does lead me to think that next year potentially has a chance to really kind of bring in that best of the best from all over. So I think we're almost there.
A final email question, and this is from John, and if you remember John from previous email questions, he has a bit of a long, multi-pronged question. So I will read as much as I can. I will get to his first question, then I will stop and we'll discuss it, and then we'll read on to the next one. So this is from John. He says, "Hi, Greg and co-host. Once again, I am sincerely so, so sorry about the length of this email, but I just needed to let some feelings out about a subject that I hope will interest you and the listeners. But I will again try to organize it as best I can with questions bolded and with a summary at the end. As you know, I like going all in detailed when sharing my views on anything I have thoughts on. First of all, what is a true difference-making draw these days in professional wrestling, and are they starting to go extinct, or have they already? Are true draws at the highest level on life support, or does it just have a broad definition and depend on how one looks at the subject? I started watching WWE in 1999, and since then there have only been a small assortment of names who I think have had that mainstream crossover megastar appeal from the moment I first saw them on screen, the wow factor. It was just a feeling I had that these following people I will list had some extra quality that was hard to explain that I believed would allow them to become a megastar outside of wrestling if they chose that path. The Rock, John Cena, Roman Reigns, AJ, not Styles, although he is one of the all-time greats and one of the best all-around performers, but former Butterfly Divas champion, so AJ Lee. Sasha Banks, Becky Lynch, despite the silly-looking goggles she was wearing at first. Bianca Belair, Alexa Bliss. If I had to pick draft style, I would pick her ahead of Sasha every time because I think she just offers more as a complete package, but both are great. Question. What do you think of these names, and would you add anyone else to your list? So Marcus, The Rock, John Cena, Reigns, AJ Lee, Sasha, Becky. I think there's more women on here than I would put. I don't know. I loved AJ Lee. I thought she had some appeal. But if we're talking megastar, wow factor, I don't know about her and Alexa. I definitely think Bianca. I've said on this show multiple times that I think she should be the person that WWE builds around. Certainly The Rock, John Cena, Roman Reigns. I don't know that there's anyone necessarily missing from that list. Like, I don't think a guy like Seth Rollins or even Dean Ambrose when he was there, Cody Rhodes, I don't really see them as having that megastar wow feel. What do you think of John's list, and is there anyone missing?
You know, it's a good list. It's a really good list. Right off the bat, I don't really see anyone to add specifically. You know, I think the era of the mega star is not over, but it's a lot harder now. You know, than it was with you know, during the days of Stone Cold and The Rock. You did have these transcendent characters that were bigger than the company, and I think that's why we're not seeing as many. Is mm-hmm. There's more focus on the company as a whole versus individual wrestlers. So yeah. You know, the WWE as a whole is this mega corporation with, you know, dealings in all sorts of different fields. The company itself is the star, is the focal yeah. point. The wrestlers are pieces of that. You know, I do think Sasha Banks being, you know, being in Star Wars, that's a huge thing. That is a huge deal. You know, even when in a relatively small role, that they, you know, they are expanding, but you know, that was a huge thing. So I don't know if there's anyone I would add, because I don't know if there's anyone that has that next level gravitas. And it's no fault to them. It's no fault to anyone, really. It's just the way the company is structured right now is just the company is the star.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So let's see if John gets into that. His email goes on. These eight names I just got that wow feeling with when I saw their first appearances on screen. I don't know why, but I just thought, oh my goodness, now this is a superstar in the regular, non-WWE sense. Some people just have that presence and rise above just being a great or even legendary wrestler. How many non-wrestling fans would know who Seth Rollins or Kevin Owens or almost anyone on the roster were if you showed them a picture? I would hope a lot would, but I get the feeling that wrestling is so niche these days that very few would. Whenever I get that wow feeling, it seems to have worked out pretty well for most of the names I mentioned. I didn't even get that feeling when I first saw Brock Lesnar, or Triple H, or Batista, or Daniel Bryan, or Edge, or Randy Orton, or Steve Austin. They have had legendary careers, and their contributions are appreciated, but I just think some people having that extra it factor that I think is something that cannot be trained or purchased. It's that intangible that I think the seven names I mentioned, I believe, had or have, and I didn't even know why I thought they had whatever they had. When I first saw them, it was a reflex. Question, is it better when a megastar emerges organically, like Daniel Bryan or Becky Lynch, or is it fine for a promotion to create and market one themselves? So I think, Marcus, that certainly it's better when a megastar emerges organically, because when you're saying organically, what you're really saying is the fans are willing that person into that spot. And if the fans are behind someone, the hardest job is done. You've got the fans to care about someone. So the promotion can certainly try to create and market a star themselves, but they've got to do it in a way that we've seen WWE fail at this before with babyface Roman Reigns. If people don't feel like the talent of that person matches the push, they're going to let the promotion know. So I think it is better when it happens organically, but you can't also as a promotion just throw wrestlers out there and say, okay, fans, which one do you like best, and we'll push them. I think you have to have some kind of a plan, but you also have to be agile enough in your booking to make changes based on what the fans want.
Oh, without a doubt. We've seen it. We've seen, like you said, we've seen both. We've seen the organic and we've seen the corporate-backed talent. And sometimes it works from the corporate perspective. Sometimes it doesn't. It is, you know, the fans like who they like, you know. And sometimes, you know, the diehards, you know, and I include myself when I say this, when we have an idea in our heads, you know, when we have a guy, when we have someone or girl, a wrestler that we can gravitate towards, we're going to stick with them, you know. And I think that's, you know, kind of being a fan is when you look at an athlete in another sport, you know, you do gravitate. You do find a player that you're like, you know what, that's who I like. That's who I'm going to keep following. You know, and in this case, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't, you know, you do have to be flexible. You do have to be willing to acknowledge that, hey, that's not working. That for whatever reason, this isn't working. You know, we've seen, you know, Roman Reigns is a great example. In recent, you know, memory, it's the Cody Rhodes end of AEW, his run, it was not clicking. Now, for whatever reason, the fans just decided that wasn't something that they wanted to pursue. For whatever reason, you know, depending on who you talk to, there's different outcomes, but, you know, was not willing to change things. And we saw how that ended up. Now Cody's in WWE and doing spectacular work. So it's sometimes an audible needs to be called. Sometimes a new environment is needed.
Yeah. Back to the email. Roman Reigns has merchandise with the phrase needle mover, and it has been well known for a while that WWE in particular doesn't focus on its biggest full-time stars besides Reigns and treat them as the biggest things ever, and it's instead the company that they promote as the big star. It's similar in a way to a Marvel or DC movie in that regard. It's not necessarily about Chris Hemsworth or Paul Rudd or Jason Momoa. It's about Thor, Ant-Man, and Aquaman. If you list all the current names who are their biggest stars who have been getting the biggest pushes in recent times, who have the most potential to attract eyeballs and be mainstream stars, these are the names. Roman Reigns, Becky Lynch, Bianca Belair, Ronda Rousey, Charlotte Flair, Alexa, this one is slightly different because she isn't necessarily as accomplished in the ring as others, but has the appeal beyond wrestling, in my opinion, and Brock Lesnar. After this, I don't think there is anyone who currently has enough appeal to have a big impact on ratings and viewership or can walk into another form of entertainment and become a leading player in Hollywood, for instance. I like to believe anyone could, but it's very unlikely. I think Austin Theory maybe has a chance if they really get behind him, but that's a big if. Question. Who do you think on the current roster can reach Rock level or higher levels of stardom outside wrestling, both today and years from now? Well, that's a really easy question, Marcus. The answer is nobody. The Rock is like the highest paid movie star in Hollywood. There's no one on the roster right now who is going to touch that. And no one. If you're talking in terms of like making a minor stir in Hollywood, perhaps getting some major movie roles, I think the list begins and ends with Roman Reigns and Bianca Belair. I really think that's it. I don't see anyone, even someone like Becky Lynch, you know, maybe. But anyone beyond that, I just don't see it.
No. Cody has dabbled in TV. You know, he did a couple spots on Arrow back, you know, a couple years back. And, you know, he was well-received. You know, Edge has done, you know, Vikings, he's done movies. And you know, he's definitely, you know, tested out other forms of media as well. But I think, for me, it's safe to say that I don't think there'll ever be another Rock. As long as I've been watching wrestling since I was 7 years old. I've never seen anything quite like The Rock, and especially when you think about how short his actual run was, you know.
Right.
There's nothing that's going to top it. You know, I think Roman, if Roman chooses to get involved in film, which I've seen that's a possibility, you know, he did well with the Fast and the Furious movie that he was in. I think that's something that's definitely on the table. I think he'll be in that higher echelon, but I don't think he'll ever be Rock level. I don't think anyone's going to be Rock level, but there are possibilities, you know, especially with the roster they have now and the wanting to be that you know cross genre, cross field star. I think it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to the email. If you look at Hollywood, there is so much emphasis on brands like Marvel, DC, Jurassic World, Mission Impossible, Star Wars, Avatar, Pixar, and so on. There are some actors who still draw to different degree, like Leonardo DiCaprio or Mark Wahlberg or Tom Cruise, but not like it was even 20 years ago. There's a reason why more and more movies are streaming service exclusives than leaving theaters more often to the biggest blockbusters. Most people just stopped watching in theaters because of individual names above the title. People love Thor swinging his hammer or dinosaurs doing almost anything on screen. It's the same with wrestling. Most casual people who do watch largely only likely watch because it's WWE, is an established brand, and probably very few only watch because of an individual name. I would even go so far as to say that if The Rock or Steve Austin came back on a full-time schedule for a year and had matches regularly on TV, the numbers would initially be huge compared to normal, but I still think that eventually people would start getting kind of used to them being around so often, and the novelty would wear off and the numbers would probably reflect those thoughts. People just have way more options for things to watch these days and devices they can watch on, from established and growing streaming services to live sports on cable. I only watch Raw and SmackDown on DVR and get through Raw within about an hour to an hour and a half and SmackDown in a similar amount of time. So Roman Reigns or Brock Lesnar being on the show doesn't really affect me or my viewing habits. But unless you watch live and specifically for a certain name, I cannot imagine why anyone would be sad or disappointed because Roman Reigns isn't on the show, other than because he is a great performer, but I'm specifically talking about casual fans. If Roman, or the guy playing Roman, honestly believes that fans will be upset because he isn't on the show, then I suggest that he may have a smidgen of narcissism, because as a faraway observer these days, there just don't appear to be any people whose presence, or lack of it, on the show has a massive difference in the ratings. I get that needle mover is probably largely to get heel heat, but I sincerely hope he doesn't actually believe he really is that these days, because I just don't think anyone can truly be a big needle mover these days. This isn't 1999. The world has changed a lot and technology has changed, and it isn't anyone's fault if 500,000 people watch or don't watch because someone is or isn't appearing on a TV show. Those kinds of big jumps at best very rarely happen. The numbers these days seem pretty steady. Question: could WWE or any other promotions bring any one name in to a massive viewership increase and sustain it over time, and who could that be? Gosh, that's so hard to say. I don't really think there's – I mean, the easiest example is CM Punk, right? I mean, he went into AEW with much fanfare, lifted ratings up. They've still been consistent, but can you attribute that entirely to CM Punk? I don't think so. So it's also hard to say because this person returning wouldn't happen in a vacuum. There are other things going on the show. And, you know, you could say, well, CM Punk brought in all these viewers, but did Punk get them to stay around? Or was it seeing the athleticism up and down the card? Is it the constant refresh of WWE superstars who've been brought into AEW over time? Is it something else, you know? So I think you could say, certainly as John said in his email, you could attribute a ratings bump to someone coming in like a Rock or a Steve Austin. But for the fans staying around, I mean, it could be other things on the show. So it's very hard to say, but I'm tempted to say no. I think, you know, I think that the fans who would come back to see The Rock will be very quickly reminded of why they no longer watch in the first place. And so I think that's kind of at play as well.
Exactly. And you know, for those fans that tune in specifically for The Rock, they will watch The Rock segment and they will immediately flip it to something different. It's because they saw who they wanted to see and then move on. CM Punk is a great example. He definitely had an impact when he first came back. But as we're seeing, you know, numbers aren't changing. They're consistent. They're good. Could be better, but they're consistent. And that's kind of how things are across the board. I don't know at this point who you could bring in. You'd almost have to bring in somebody from the outside. But at this point, I don't know who. You know, WWE, you know, brought in Ronda Rousey and brought her back. And again, a spike, but then it kind of leveled off. The only one I can think of off the top of my head would be almost a Conor McGregor level, and even he's kind of fallen off over the years. I think someone like him would bring in numbers, would spike, would, you know, quote unquote, move the needle, but then the needle would move back. So at this point, you know, I think wrestling's changed so much. You know, there's only so many hours in a day. There's only so many hours in a week, you know, and you have to kind of curate what you can and can't watch. And now, you know, with the rise of streaming services and streaming platforms, you know, 20 years ago, it was just WWE readily available. I mean, you can get, you know, Ring of Honor through, you know, different means, and that, you know, I would have to dig and I would get my DVDs, but, you know, something that was readily available was pretty much only WWE. Now, there's AEW, there's Impact, but going on the other end of the spectrum, there's more access to independent promotions, there's more access to global promotions. If for me personally as a fan, if I have a spare moment, for me, I'm probably not going to catch up on Raw or SmackDown right off the bat. I'm probably going to go catch up on my New Japan, on my Pro Wrestling NOAH, on my, you know, independent promotions that I follow. There's so many different options now that, you know, entertainment has changed. Wrestling has changed. And I don't know, you know, how, the end game for that, but it's just, I don't know if there's one particular person that could come in and just all of a sudden, you know, the light bulb goes off and there's, you know, millions upon millions upon millions of people watching a particular program. I don't see that.
Yeah. So back to the email, one more question for John. First, his conclusion. Draws and needle movers in wrestling, and indeed entertainment in general, isn't as important an idea currently, although if you push talented stars strong enough, it is still a better option than 50-50 booking, and they can still provide a small boost of ratings and viewership. On another quick but similar subject, who is this MJF people speak of? I've never watched AEW, but on podcasts I have heard people describe him as like nothing else in wrestling today, like he's a once-in-a-generation performer, even though according to some he isn't the very best in the ring. I heard he did this promo that was described as a pipe bomb-style promo, supposedly going off-script, although my natural inclination, not having seen it, is that it was designed to feel that way, to make people talk, and was at least 70 to 100% planned. There are a lot of great in-ring performers and a decent number of great promos in WWE today. What makes him any better or more valuable than a Kevin Owens or Becky Lynch or Roman Reigns or even Matt Riddle or Austin Theory? If you had to describe him and make comparisons for a non-AEW viewer, what would you say? Keep up the great work. Thank you, John. Marcus, who is this MJF that people are speaking of? Where to begin? So to answer the specific question, if you had to describe him and make comparisons, what would you say? The most common comparisons, and I don't know when John started watching wrestling, so I don't know if these comparisons are going to mean anything to him, but most people compare him to Roddy Piper in terms mm-hmm. of a heel and the way he gets heat. MJF himself has often spoken of Piper in his promos. There's been a little bit of Brian Pillman lately with this worked shoot aspect of his character. I don't know that he compares to Pillman in the ring, but from a personality, what's he going to say or do next standpoint, I think there's a little bit of that crazy like a fox type Brian Pillman to him. I think some people would compare him to The Miz as far as in the ring. I think that's shortchanging MJF a little bit, because he's been able to rise to the occasion when he's been in against some major stars in major matches. So I think he does get shortchanged a little bit when people talk about his in-ring. But, you know, for someone like John, who's never seen MJF or never watched AEW, but hears about this guy on podcasts, especially the last week or two, it's been almost all MJF, how would you describe him? What comparison point would you make?
Andy Kaufman.
Okay. Interesting.
There's a level of not necessarily a meta, but there's a
he's got that commitment. He's got that commitment to his character.
In a world where, you know, kayfabe is non-existent. You know, wrestlers break character all the time on Twitter and social media, and even just, you know, seeing a wrestler down the street just hanging out. You know, they will drop their, for the most part, drop the character, and you're not dealing with the character, you're dealing with the person. MJF is MJF 24/7. And I have not seen that in a very long time, and that is what intrigues me about him as a character and him as a person. You know, I remember seeing him years ago in Wrestle Circus and just thinking that this kid's going to be something different. And then he moves on to MLW, and just you can see the character start to evolve. Then getting where he's at now on AEW, he is this – there is no – line between him and the character. He is MJF 24/7, you know, in the way he interacts with fans, or in, you know, this case, the Double or Nothing weekend, not interacting with fans. You know, there's a deep commitment to the bit, which is very interesting to me. Now in ring, you know, I don't know. In AEW, in 3 years, he's had 22 matches, give or take. So we really haven't had an opportunity to see what he can do. You know, he's had good matches, you know, with CM Punk's a prime example. He's definitely capable, but he, you know, for me, it's the character work that stands out. And that is something that you don't see a whole lot of. Now, and it's sure something you don't see on the level that he uses.
Back in the early days of Wrestling Night in America, back when Pat McNeil was hosting and I was the co-host each week, MJF was actually a guest on this show. We had him on here. We talked to him. I think this was – he may have been in MLW at the time. But, yes, he was fully in character. I think he – I think there's something about my name that he didn't like, and he told me I needed to change it. So that was my interaction with MJF being a guest on the show. And I'm sure you can find that on the archives of pwtorch.com. If you're a VIP member, you can go back to when Pat McNeil and I interviewed him before he got super famous And he was the same MJF that you see on TV. So that was my brush with fame, I guess, interviewing MJF here on Wrestling Night in America. But before we go, and I know we've kept you on for a long time, Marcus, so thanks for sticking with us. Slammiversary, got to talk about the card because next week we're going to be going on the air after Slammiversary goes off the air. So I just want to run down the card here, briefly talk about it. From the top down, Josh Alexander versus Eric Young for the Impact Championship. Ace Austin versus Kenny King versus Speedball. Mike Bailey versus Trey Miguel versus Alex Zane versus, and here, Jack Evans. Ultimate X match for the X Division title. I almost couldn't read Evans' name. My handwriting is terrible when I write fast, and this is no good. Tasha Steelz versus Chelsea Green versus Deonna Purrazzo versus Jordan Grace versus Mia Yim in a Queen of the Mountain match for the Knockouts title. Mickie James will be the special enforcer in that one. The Briscoes take on the Good Brothers in a match for the Impact Tag titles. It will be Alex Shelley, Chris Sabin, Kazarian, and two to be announced versus Eddie Edwards, Matt Taven, Mike Bennett, PCO, and Vincent in a 10-man tag match. The first team is Impact Originals, so you can expect two wrestlers from Impact's past being a part of that. Sami Callihan takes on Moose in a Monsters Ball match, and Rich Swann versus Brian Myers for the Impact Digital Media Championship. So that is Slammiversary. It's being billed as the 20th anniversary of Slammiversary. So, Marcus, your thoughts on the card just overall?
It's an interesting card looking at it. There is a interesting blend of, you know, it's funny with it being the 20th anniversary, there is a blend of the original generation versus the current Impact iteration. You know, I think the title match, I think that's going to be fantastic. Josh Alexander has been just a step above almost everybody out there right now. Eric Young being an Impact original, it's fitting to have him in this main event. The other one that really stands out for me is the Honor No More Impact Originals match. I don't know who the other two originals are going to be. I have my hopes, that being Shark Boy and Curry Man, but that's just me purely speculating. That's just who I want. But again, I do like this idea of the past meeting not just the present, but also the future, you know, and we're seeing that with especially the Knockouts match, that is, you know, one, having a Queen of the Mountain match it takes an already interesting concept to a new level. And then just the talent involved in that, it's such a wide variety of styles. I think that could be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the one thing that stands out to me is, you know, you have this group of former ROH wrestlers led by Eddie Edwards, and at the last pay-per-view, they won their match. They were granted a part of the Impact roster. And now, all these months later, they're still fighting Impact wrestlers. It's still like it's almost like that nothing changed. They're still seen as the outsiders. They're still fighting an Impact. So, I mean, what was the point of them winning? I don't know. That's a minor issue, I think, with this. But, yeah, I think the women's match is interesting. There's a lot of talent in that match for the Queen of the Mountain. Obviously, the X Division title match, the Ultimate X, is going to be really good. You know, Eric Young, as the challenger for the Impact title, feels a little underwhelming, even though, yes, it's Slammiversary, and yes, it's the 20th anniversary, and yes, Eric Young is seen as an Impact original. But they only get four of these a year. And so I kind of feel like there should be more of a major contender for these matches on pay-per-view. I don't know. Again, it's a minor quibble. I think Callahan versus Moose in the Monsters Ball match should be pretty wild. So yeah, this is Slammiversary next Sunday night, as I said, and we'll be going on the air here on Wrestling Night in America, taking your phone calls and emails after Slammiversary goes off the air. Probably have a co-host with me. I'm going to try and get Darren Lilly, who joined me on the last Impact pay-per-view after that, to kind of help guide us through it. So going to be a lot of fun next Sunday after Slammiversary. We do have one more phone call. Sean from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. He tweeted me. He wants to talk to Marcus. So before we go, Sean,
okay,
we're going to put him on the air. Sean, the reason you were not in the queue, I saw you bouncing back and forth, actually, between being in the queue and to talk and being in the queue to listen. So I do see you in the queue now to talk, so I'm putting you on the air. This better be good, Sean.
Well, first, Greg, I will say my phone, I had thought I got initially back in, and I was actually at someone's house. So I was, like, outside of their house trying to make sure I was in the queue, and then I thought about it for a while.
My goodness. The dedication.
Yeah, what if I'm not? Yeah, and then I got home, and I've been home this, you know, since you guys have been talking for a long time, and I was like, let me check again. I'm like, oh, well, no wonder, like, I'm not, because I'm not even in the daggum queue. What is wrong with my flipping phone? It's so annoying. But anyway, Greg, it's always good to talk to you, my friend. Marcus,
yep,
it's nice to have a fresh voice on here, man. How are you doing, man? Good to talk to you.
Hey, I'm well. I'm well, Sean. I'm glad you called in. I'm looking forward to maybe talking with you. So I'm glad you called in, sir.
Yeah, I won't go, you know, too long. I know you, obviously it's been a 2-hour call, and there's, you know, you guys have talked about a lot. First, I will say, John, those emails are awesome, dude. Oh my gosh, those are the most in-depth emails I've ever seen in my entire life. But I mean, that takes dedication. You think I'm dedicated? That guy's dedicated. So give it up to him. But I wanted to go talk kind of just quick about AEW, what you guys were talking about, and you know, I thought Wade and Todd, like you said, did a really good job of kind of talking about a lot of the issues AEW does have right now, and you guys, you know, talked about it in depth with a lot of it. But I wanted to even go kind of going back to, we haven't really talked about a lot of the women's divisions yet at all tonight. And with Thunder Rosa, I mean, I like Thunder Rosa a lot. I think she's done an okay job as champion, but I think they've just kind of cooled her off, because going back to Wednesday, you know, her, Marina Shafir, all of a sudden just getting a title shot. Like, she doesn't deserve a title shot. She's done nothing to earn any kind of title shot. And to go in there and all of a sudden have this little interview thing with Thunder Rosa, and then her kind of come in and, you know, bombard and say, you're my problem, I'm going to whatever, and then all of a sudden she just gets a title match. And another thing AEW's been bad, but WWE at times has been bad too, and that they've gotten plenty of criticism for it. But I just think AEW all around has just been really rough the last couple of weeks. And what did you think about Thunder Rosa? What do you think she's doing as champion? What do you think the build to that was? Did you like that at all? Where do you think they're going with the women's division?
Yeah, I really didn't like that. I think Marina Shafir, they're really struggling with her. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of crowd interest in her. I thought the match, it looked like, you know, and I know there's been some people on social media saying that, and I had to go back and watch the match the second time, that it looked like there were some spots where Rosa was not cooperating with Shafir. Like, they were, I mean, they kind of masked it by looking like they were chain wrestling, but it was, it did not look like things went smoothly in that match. So, you know, I liked the idea of Rosa as champion. I don't think putting her with Marina Shafir did her any favors, and maybe she thought that too. I don't know. It's just, I also agree, you know, when you are, and I said this before, you know, when you make it a point to build your company around the idea that wins and losses matter, and that that's going to be kind of what sets you apart and what earns people shots at the title, people expect you to adhere to that pretty strictly. And so when AEW goes off and they do something like have Marina Shafir challenge for the title despite not having any major wins, that's what gets people upset. That's something people have kind of come to expect that from WWE, so you don't hear the outrage about it anymore. But I think people hold AEW to a higher standard, fair or unfair, Marcus, but that's kind of the sense that I get.
You know, AEW has made such a point to do the ranking system, do the wins and losses matter, and that's great. They do, but what we're seeing is the issue that arises when companies try to build that. you know, you kind of book yourselves into a corner for a lot of things. Two, we are doing this thing of just random matches. Now you can use the caveat of, well, you know, Thunder Rosa is a fighting champion, and if Marina wants a match, then great, she'll do it. But again, that creates a slippery slope of just, if that's the case, if someone just needs to ask for a title match, then why? Why have the ranking systems? Why put an emphasis on that if you can just hypothetically walk up to a champion and say, hey, you don't have a match. I know you're not booked tonight. I'm not booked tonight either. Let's go have a match. You can, and that's fine. You want to do that, that's great. But then de-emphasize the ranking system. My issue right now is, you know, I like Thunder Rosa, but I don't know what the end game for her title run is going to be. You know, when Britt Shida, it was this, you know, culmination of a long-term storyline. When Thunder Rosa beat Britt Baker, it was a culmination of a long-term storyline, and then this. You know, moment of triumph. I don't know what the payoff is going to be for this particular title run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sean, any follow-up or another question you have for us?
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And, you know, going back to what you guys were talking about too, with bringing a lot of the New Japan stars in, like, I do not get a chance to watch. And I've heard, obviously, Todd, you guys have talked about it so much, and I keep up with, like, you know, who's winning and what, you know, but I don't know enough. And, like, I've heard so many great things about Will Ospreay. I've tried to see a couple of matches. So when he first appeared Wednesday, like, I didn't really honestly recognize who he was. And so I felt bad because I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, well, I should know, but that's what AEW needs to do is about these guys, give you more. Just, oh, Will Ospreay's here. Well, some people don't know who he is, unfortunately. I should. But a lot of people don't. And so, you know, keep them up to speed on who these people are that are coming in. And, you know, they're just, you know, again, they're bringing so many people in. But going back to the WWE, a couple things with their women's division. Did you like – I mean, Judgment Day is what it is. I didn't like, you know, Edge. I like that Edge is turning babyface, but I don't like the way they did it, just the guys turning on him. I just think that's a dumb way of turning someone babyface, but – Edge needs to be a babyface. Like you said, Marcus, the fans are going to get behind him no matter what, that they love him. But going back to, like, Judgment Day with Rhea, from Rhea, do you like that they're going to her and Bianca as fast as they are? Because I feel like they could have built a longer thing. Now, granted, Judgment Day is, you know, different with Finn, you know, Finn or whoever's going to lead it. But I think they could have built it maybe at least Rhea and Bianca to SummerSlam and maybe had, even though – Piper Niven's wrestled Bianca before. I'm like, Todd, I don't say the other name. I just say Piper Niven because I can't stand that other name. I think it's really dumb. But with Piper Niven, I think they could have – I know she's wrestled Bianca, and they've had a couple good matches. I feel like they could have at least built Piper up for this spot. I know she could be a lot more in WWE, but, and they just don't, I guess, see a lot in her, I guess. I don't know why. She's really talented. She's got a great look. I mean, she's obviously got the size. But – I think they could have done something with her and Bianca, at least at Money in the Bank, built up a couple weeks to that, and then have Rhea at least at SummerSlam or maybe even farther down the line. What did you think of? Do you think too quick they're going to Rhea and Bianca? How do you think they've built to that?
I think the problem with going to Piper Niven /Doudrop is you've had Bianca beat her on TV so many times, especially in the lead up to the match, you know, against Becky Lynch, that It would have taken a lot to reheat her, and WWE just, I don't think they have that in them to do that. I like the addition of Rhea Ripley into Judgment Day. I think that's a good fit for her, and I think it's, I don't mind them going to Bianca Rhea right now, because ultimately SummerSlam is probably going to be Bianca Belair, Becky Lynch again, especially with the way the triple threat with Asuka ended, with Asuka taking the fall, so Becky Lynch still hasn't lost yet in a rematch to Bianca Belair. So I think Belair gets by Rhea Ripley, and the next opportunity is going to be against Becky Lynch at SummerSlam. But I think Rhea Ripley down the line can be a major player and could be someone who is a real long-term opponent for Bianca Belair. I just don't think that's right now. Marcus, what's your take on that?
You know, I agree. I think as it stands right now, and we're in that time of the year where we know SummerSlam is, you know, coming up soon. And so everything from now to SummerSlam is not secondary, but definitely a notch lower. And so whatever programs they're building, they're not going to be something, you know, top tier. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And so they're kind of not scrambling. They're trying to build what they can, but, you know, they know that the long-term end game here is going to be SummerSlam. And so, you know, we've seen that before. We've seen that since they started establishing, you know, the big four, so to speak. You know, I'm with you, though. I think Piper, I would love for them to build her up. I would love to make her, like, a credible threat and maybe even hold the title at some point. I'm a big fan of her work. I think she's got the charisma. She's got the look. I think she's, you know, someone that they can build around. I don't know why they haven't done anything more with her over the years, but you know, I do expect, you know, some opportunity down the line. And then yeah, I think SummerSlam is going to be Bianca and Becky. See what happens.
All right, Sean, anything else for us tonight?
Yeah, first I wanted to go back to just Riddle really fast and say I love what Riddle's doing right now. He has become, you know, a serious guy, a serious contender. Like, yes, is he going to lose this match? Yeah, I don't see how he wins. But I just love what they're doing with him. I think they're on a long-term story with him, and I think they finally figured it out, in my opinion, with him. And I'm curious to see, you know, if they just – when Orton comes back, whenever he does, they just part ways, or, you know, wherever they go. I'm really intrigued what they're doing with Matt. I think he's doing a good job. But the last question I was going to bring up was Gunther winning the Intercontinental title. I think it's good for him. I mean, he needed to win that. If he's going to wrestle it, Ricochet, he needs to win it. But is this a step down for him, or do you think it's a process for him just to build up and eventually – you know, sometime down the line, I guess it could be a year down the line, could be two, but written all over him. Like, I love everything about him. I love his demeanor. I love his power. I love his hard-hitting style. I mean, the match with Ricochet was good for what it was. I mean, it was two different styles, but I thought they meshed it well for the time that they had. But where do you think they're going with Gunther? Do you like what they've done so far? And that's really all I had, Greg. Man, I know it's late. I appreciate you taking the call, man. Marcus, always good to talk to you, man. I hope I get to talk to you more, and thank you guys for taking my call, as always.
For sure, Sean. Thank you.
So, Gunther, I think it's a good trajectory to see him win the secondary title right now. It's a good sign. However, I can't look at him and not think Cesaro. Somebody who probably will have a long career if they want it, who will carry the in-ring portion of TVs and pay-per-views, but who I struggle to see as someone the company will get behind as a champion, because I think that's his ceiling, right? Like, we've seen him as Walter in NXT and NXT UK and other places have that kind of presence and have that kind of potential. But on the main roster, it's a different animal. And so I worry that his ceiling is going to be Cesaro, just falling short of being a title contender, someone who fans for years cite as someone criminally underrated by the company. That being said, they seem to be doing well with him for now in the booking. I think he's right about on that path where you'd want to be if you're a new introduction to the main roster.
I agree. Cesaro is a really good comparison. Gunther, Walter, you know, whatever you want to call him, you know, he has potential to really be something special in WWE. He's been something special everywhere else he's been. And again, same with Cesaro. You look back at both of their careers, they have done so much in so many other places. But for some reason, you know, yeah, Cesaro hit that ceiling and, you know, he was not going to get past that. They would kind of flirt with the main event with him a little bit, but never really, you know, pulled the trigger. And I do think that's a remote possibility for Gunther. He's somebody that has that independent credibility, you know, being all over. You know, I always think about his Monster Progress run where he was just unbeatable. And he was just something that was just so different from everything that was going on. You know, we talked about throwbacks and Gunther is the throwback of throwbacks. You know, he's just his body type, his wrestling style. He is just, you know, nothing fancy, just chops, power bombs, and slams, and that's all you need for someone like him. You know, him getting the Intercontinental title does show me that they have some faith in whatever he's doing. You know, he's gotten himself in really good shape in recent months. So he's taken some, you know, company criticism to heart, and he's improved his look. He is doing his best to kind of roll with the quote-unquote WWE style. So I don't know. I want him to succeed. I think he's somebody that a lot of people can get behind. I do worry that, you know, there is a finite point for, you know, where he can go with this.
Well, Marcus, we've reached the end of the program. Thank you so much for sticking around so late. I know I quoted you 90 minutes, and we've blown past that. So I do appreciate it. Before I let you go ahead and plug where people can follow you on social media and when and where they can find your work for the Torch.
Yeah. So first off, like I say, thank you so much for letting me be a part of this. This was a tremendous, tremendous treat. So, gosh, thank you. I'm usually on Twitter. You can get me at Mega Man Mex, M-E-X, where I do pretty much all my random wrestling thoughts and random musings. So if you like random pithy comments about professional wrestling and comic books, I'm your guy.
That's what Twitter is all about, after all.
I know. That's why, you know, sometimes it's a horrible, horrible place, but every once in a while it can be awesome. As far as the Torch goes, I have been writing the TV reports for MLW Fusion. Been doing that since January already, so you guys can check that out. I just put up the most recent one for MLW's Rise of the Renegades special. They have the MLW Battle Riot coming up soon, so that'll be a big show with some potential consequences. That should be pretty neat. So check that out. That's all I got. But Greg, again, thank you to the callers, thank you to the emailers, and again, thank you to you. Like I say, when you messaged me to be on here, I was completely flabbergasted, but I am so grateful to hang out with you guys tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and we'll have you on again soon.
All right. Look forward to it, Greg. Thank you.
Excellent. No problem. And thank everybody for listening. Don't forget, we're going on the air next week after Slammiversary on Sunday night. So make sure to tune in. If you're watching Impact, watch the pay-per-view. Send in your email, wnialivecast@gmail.com. Send in your questions there. Or call us up, 515-605-9345. We'll be talking about that show. And I'm sure some other big events coming up soon. You can follow me on Twitter, @GregMParks. And check out my full-page column each and every week in the Torch newsletter. I was on Then and Now with Frank Pettiani this week. So check out that show as well. We talked about Backlash 2000. So a lot of fun getting to talk some of the old school WWF. And, yes, 2000 now counts as old school. So anyway, I'm done talking, mercifully, probably, for some of you. So thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next Sunday, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.